Right, welcome back for our last session. And I've already touched a couple of times on the question of the extent to which the IP system has self-correcting mechanisms to deal with abuses and the extent to which it needs external correction. And that really takes us to the focus of this session, starting off with Amandine Leonard from the University of Edinburgh.
Thank you. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer that question, but I'll do my best. But there might be something about the internal, external limits that actually fit with the team. So thank you for having me today, Lionel. Thank you for the invitation. It's my pleasure. Abuse of intellectual property rights has definitely been on my agenda for quite a bit of time, as I actually wrote my PhD on abuse of rights. So it seems quite fitting for today. And especially to the question of, does the UK need a distinct doctrine of abuse of rights, lessons from civil law? As you can tell, either by my accent or my name, I'm not from the UK. I'm from Belgium, so from a civil law country, despite the fact that now I've moved to Edinburgh. So I'm in between waters. So for those kind of source and origin of abuse of rights, according to some authors, the prohibition of abuse of rights finds its roots in Roman law, in particular to the concept of emulatio, the intention to harm, or the exceptio doli generalis, which means that right holders should not use their right in an inequitable way. It has also evolved in parallel with, it's hard to really pinpoint the full relationship between, and we've heard kind of some linguistic or some terms being used today that kind of connect abuse of rights to fraud or good faith, bad faith. I think that definitely there's a intense connection there between good faith, bad faith and abuse of rights. And that's kind of the origin of the doctrine of abuse of rights. If we look at it from a more property law perspective, as intellectual property may find some similarities with property law in terms of exercising those rights, we have quite old cases, especially from France, already in 1855 in the Colmar case with the idea, which resonates a bit with the quote that was on the program for today, at least the beginning of it, where we say that in principle, the right of property is in some way absolute. So that is something that we may have seen also being claimed for intellectual property. There is this idea of I can do what I want within the sphere of my rights. Nonetheless, we see already back then that the exercise of that right may have limits, and in particular, the satisfaction of a serious and legitimate interest. The principles of morality, equity are important in understanding those limits, and that we should not allow unjustified actions or exercise of those rights, especially when they bring harm to another party. So here are some kind of multiple components that we could see falling within a general principle of not abusing, not misusing one's rights, even if it starts from this idea of absolute property. It was followed, and that's considered to be really the first case in which the theory, the doctrine of abuse of rights has its footing, is in the Clément Bayard case in France of 1915, so it's been quite a minute, where we do have the general claim that a right cannot be exercised with the sole intention of harming another, especially when the right holder has no legitimate interest in the act. It's kind of a broad definition of what an abuse could be, but that was really the starting point and the key case in which abuse of rights has been recognized as a doctrine in civil law countries. There are, however, numerous civil law versions of abuse. Many countries have adopted or incorporated an abuse of right provision or theory in their legislation. Here, I've just shown a snippet of five jurisdictions: Belgium, obviously, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Spain. Different legal bases in which we find an anchorage for a claim of abuse of rights. 1382, in Belgium and France, which is basically a fault-based regime, quite simple principles. More recently, Belgium has even codified the abuse of rights principle in its civil law code. Germany has principles that also are attached to abuse of rights, the Netherlands as well, and Spain as well. You can see the foundation may differ depending on the civil jurisdiction that we're looking at. Belgium, before 2023, had a purely jurisprudential construction of abuse of rights. Same for France. While on the other hand, we have Germany, the Netherlands, and Spain, which have a codification of abuse of rights. Something that was kind of mentioned already, I think it was Quentin in your presentation about abuse of rights or abuse connected to competition law, this idea of mixing an objective and a subjective element to test whether a right holder has abused its right. And here again, in all version, national version of abuse, we find this two-footing on objective and subjective criterion. I dropped Spain, but just for the purpose of my PhD, I did not have time to cover Spain. There should be an additional column for the UK, actually, which was part of my PhD, and which will come maybe in the answer to the main question of the presentation. But so essentially, it was my PhD looked into five jurisdictions, four here on the slide from civil law perspective, trying to understand what is an abuse of rights, when do we face a scenario of abuse, which brings some of the question, the main question for today. And in particular, do we find those types of abuse in patent litigation? So I'm an IP person, but more specifically a patent person. And so I was intrigued to see how abuse of right had been understood within the framework of patent litigation. All of it was triggered by patent trolls in the US, the question of there was a lot of trolling, abuses. You could see in the news big headlines with abuse of patent system, abuse of patent rights. So I was intrigued to see how do we match the two. Is there something that is about abuse of rights, or is it completely different? And if it is abuse of right, what does it mean? So from a purely theoretical perspective, the four jurisdictions that I looked into kind of approach abuse with a similar structure, where you engage first with this idea of an overarching principle, a generic criteria of abuse, which for Belgium is the idea of the limits of a normal exercise of subjective rights by a careful and cautious person placed in the same circumstances are manifestly exceeded. So that's kind of a generic approach to what is an abuse. Sounds vague, obviously it's the theory, right? But that gives us kind of an idea of some contour of abuse of rights. Similarly, you have a definition for France, which looks into an abus caractérisé, which also has this idea of a right holder who does not act as a normally prudent and reasonable person who would act in the same circumstances. Germany, on the other hand, actually connects really strongly questions of abuse of rights to the principle of good faith. So that's slightly different than what we see in France and Belgium, which has a more of a reasonableness type of approach. And the Netherlands goes back to a more reasonableness, fairness principle. Although it also has a very specific provision on abuse of powers, which is less about abuse of right from a subjective rights perspective, but it's still there for the sake of completeness. Beyond this generic criteria, how do we determine when we are facing either an abus caractérisé or when we are facing or meeting the general definition of Belgium? Courts have, over the years, developed different kind of specific criteria to substantiate the generic one. And here in Belgium, you see there's similarities, they're put in parallel column for a reason, where you do have multiple specific criteria that help us understand when we're facing an abuse. And then you have the intention to harm, which does not come as a surprise. Intention, we've heard it quite a lot today as well. The idea that somebody did something either on purpose, on the basis of certain knowledge, it knew it was wrong, but still went for it, or there was an intention to obtain something that it should not have been there in the first place. So this intention to harm is quite present across a specific criteria. Other criterion include the right function, so rights exist for a certain purpose. Are we exercising those rights against that function? Are we doing what is expected of the law? Is it expected from the legislator? Is that what we want to see happening or not? If you exercise that right in a manner that contravenes that purpose, that function, are you abusing your right? It's a possibility under those specific criteria. Proportionality comes as a specific criteria of abuse. There's been a lot of discussion in patent sphere in particular, but I mean, not exclusively, IP more generally, I'd say, about the role of proportionality. Should we have more consideration for proportionality, especially when it comes to remedies? Is there more to be done there? Here we see that proportionality is a bit of abuse, but not exclusively encompassing abuse, or vice versa. And then we have slightly more specific criteria about the different ways of exercising your right, which equally brings benefits to you, but you pick the one that causes the most harm to another. So it's not too far for proportionality, but the angle is slightly different. When you behave grossly inequitably, or you have no regards for the legitimate interest of third parties or the public, or again, when you engage your right in a disproportionate manner regarding the interest served and the interest harmed, so there's also this balancing. There are criteria which are connected to abuse. They're not necessarily understood as the specific criterion to fill the generic criteria of abuse, but they have loose connection to it. It's all kind of connected to estoppel and the national version of estoppel. But I'm not going to go into that too much. I think it might be already too much. What do these definitions or understanding of generic specific criteria have in common? A common definition for abuse of right is essentially that it's considered as an internal correcting mechanism applicable to all subjective rights, which allow judges to have some discretionary powers in case not foreseen by the legislator, so a little bit of flexibility, and essentially a tool to remedy an imbalanced situation, hence the proportionality element, or a tool for recovery of a distorted exercise of a right. And there the right function bit come into play as well. For Sophie Staines, who's also an alumna of KU Leuven, she defined an abuse as a crossing of internal limits, revealing that despite adherence to formal and external limits, the exercise of a right is reprehensible. In some way is being on the trying to find the equilibrium between the exercise is not necessarily illegal, but it might be illegitimate. And it's that balance that is quite important, which also makes it slightly different from the point of view of competition law, which may be seen more as a breach of a different body of law. You act in an anti-competitive manner under the guide of what competition law tells you. That does not necessarily mean that you're abusing your right from an internal perspective at an IP level. So I think that abuse of rights and abuse of dominant position respond to very different criteria and apply in very different settings. And the sanction of abuse, we kind of started with the question of sanction this morning about trademark and what's an appropriate sanction for abuse. It was, in theory, considered that the appropriate sanction is the reduction of the exercise to what may be considered a proper exercise of a right by a judicial authority. This morning it was mentioned that maybe that reduction is not the most efficient or not the best outcome for abuse. There might be other options out there that I'll come up with in a minute. Beyond the purely national version, and we haven't touched upon that yet, but beyond the national version of abuse, there's also the recognition of an EU general principle, autonomous principle of the prohibition of abuse of rights, which has gradually been developed by the Court of Justice and recognized in 2007 in the Kofut case, which tells us that where we see that the court explicitly referred to the general community law principle that abuse of right is prohibited. So it's not just a national civil kind of approach. There's also this EU level principle that exists and which again mixes subjective and objective criterion. So that comes back every single time. However, it's clear that the subjective elements are not purely limited to the intentions of a right holder or a person. You don't have to sound the mind of a right holder to figure out if subjectively they had some bad intentions. You can find a series of factors, and again, Quentin, you mentioned a list of factors that are possible to demonstrate that the exercise of a right may reach the threshold of an abuse. So we can objectify the subjective element. So to conclude, in theory, it sounds amazing, right? I mean, there's plenty of options. We can look everywhere. There's something. And indeed, in the countries that I've looked into, you have a relatively similar understanding, despite clear differences in the specific criteria and the generic criteria. But There is a spirit that is shared between the different countries. You have objective or subjective elements. The sanction seems to be quite similar in terms of reduction. It is considered as a pervasive legal concept. So regardless of the right that you're exercising, there should be some room for an argument based on abuse. It's an internal mechanism, again, because it's not based on that specific legal field. It's for all rights. And it has an interpretative and corrective functions. I'm not going to go into that. At the EU level, we also saw there's an autonomous principle of union law. It's great. It has a two-step kind of a test. Again, interpretative and corrective function. And you have to have some kind of consistent interpretation between the national version of abuse and the EU version of abuse. How does that translate eventually in IP? Strong underpinning in the Paris Convention, the TRIPS Agreement, the Enforcement Directive as an Article 3.2, which is usually talked about for other things than just abuse, but there is abuse literally, explicitly written in 3.2, which is considered as a specific anti-abuse provision for enforcement of IP. And the UP regime, despite they are actually not explicitly referring to abuse, embraces principles of proportionality, flexibility, fairness, and equity. So that sounds great in theory, right? Why not? And as academic, we love theory. But I was kind of interested in the practice as well. So I did engage into a multinational case law analysis, trying to figure out, as I said, how does abuse of right work in practice in front of national courts in the framework of patent litigation. So obviously it has limitation because I'm not looking at anything that may happen outside of the exercise of right understood as what's happening in litigation. But I looked into the same four countries plus the UK, all kind of keywords that would bring all the different notions in multiple languages, because otherwise the EU is not fun. Abuse, good faith, bad faith, reasonableness, unreasonableness, the codified version of abuse, finding really the proper article, connecting a little bit to unjustified warning letters, threatening demand letters. There was quite a bit of abuse related to that as well. And that covered more or less 400 cases, or uncovered more or less 400 cases, in which an argument of abuse had been raised, not necessarily a win, but at least the question of abuse had been popped in front of the judge, and there was maybe some treatment of its meaning. What I looked into is really a series of rights that have been questioned under the umbrella of abuse. So the right to send notices or warning letters, the right to sue as such, the right to appeal, the right to request evidentiary measures as well as preliminary injunctions, the right to obtain remedies in case of infringement, and finally, the right to act before administrative bodies. It's a bit of a subset of what I've seen, but since it came in the case law, I think it's important to include it. So that would be really the abusive exercise that was claimed, but since most of the regime are based on a traditional liability rule of an exercise that caused harm and there must be a causal link between the two, I also wanted to unpack what was the harm caused, what was the causal link between the two, what sanctions or safeguards may be there, is there a room for an abuse claim, and what kind of counterbalancing factors may we already have within the system. And here, Katarina, I think that there is some commonalities in terms of counterbalancing factors that are already embedded that resonate with your presentation as well. And so the conclusion of all of that was that, yes, there is a solid theory of abuse of right already available. However, there is a really strict interpretation as to what abuse is. It's not a loose version of abuse that would make its way to findings of abuse. It is also considered as a last resort mechanism. So other things were coming into play before relying on abuse of rights from a civil law perspective. Competition law was used first, other general principles. In Germany, a lot of other Latin maxim that may have been used to try to defend or not the behavior of right holders. The cases where abuse has been found were highly exceptional, included highly exceptional circumstances. So again, it's not your everyday argument that you're going to bring before the court. Most civil law courts had recognized that we hear you, kind of makes sense, but we have limited discretionary power. So if you can't attach the behavior to something that we have, it's going to be difficult for us to claim or to find that there is an abuse. And something that really came out very clearly from the case law is that the subjective elements, the intention to harm, the knowledge, took over any kind of potential objective findings of abuse. So the question of proportionality, the question of right function, even if in theory they exist, in practice, they kind of go through the door. And in some ways, today, as I was listening to the presentation, and even when we were talking about abuse in the other presentation, at some point, there was intent, there was no knowledge, and that kind of destroyed the argument of abuse, and that came out of the case law as well. So not great compared to the big green V, we have a big red cross, so a little bit less fun. And so this is, looking at time just to make sure, maybe this is not necessary. So the idea in the PhD was that how can we make this work maybe a little bit better? And how could we infuse maybe more flexibility within the existence of abuse, which is meant to be a flexible type of mechanism? Long story short, lots of colors. That's how my brain works, with a lot of pictures and lots of colors. The idea is really to focus on those objective assessments. So the bit in the middle, with the light blue, disproportionate exercise, contradictory behavior, the right function. I think there is much more that could be done and that we should maybe forget a tiny bit the intentional part, and that the subjective elements are not always the key for finding an abuse, that there might be other more objective circumstances that allow us to find that there is an abuse. So in conclusion, there are some advantages of abuse of rights. It's technically quite flexible, right? We saw all the different criteria. So if you have a relatively long list, you could think, okay, it could work. It could be a useful tool for unforeseen borderline cases. Again, I'm not saying that everyone should claim that there's an abuse every 5 minutes. It has a potential of striking a fair balance between a lawfully acquired right, the interest of third parties, and the functions of those rights in question. So that could be a bit more front and center. And it has the potential to restore some of the internal balance that we have within the IP system. I would say that it's not the same as proportionality. I was told many times that why do we care about abuse if we can just infuse more proportionality? And I would say actually proportionality, as you've seen, is a specific criteria of abuse, but there might be other things there. There might be more that we could do where we don't have to engage always with the balancing of interest between the party, between the right holder or the alleged infringer. There might be other reasons why we think the right holder has stepped too far, especially when we look at contradictory behavior or the right function criterion again. I think there, it's not about proportionality. It's not about necessarily the interest of a third party. It's really about this internal, inward looking as to how was that right exercised by the right holder. Main difficulties, and I can see some skeptical faces in the room. I'm used to it by now, so there's no problem with that. I think the word abuse is a problem in some ways. The linguistic of it is a problem. If you tell someone that you're abusing your right, it's going to be a tough one to swallow, right? Just the word of it. It has a high threshold of demonstrating that somebody has abused their right, because harassment, irritation in the exercise of a right, potentially annoying exercise is not the same as an abuse, so it's going to be difficult. There's a heavy burden of proof on whomever brings a claim of abuse, and clearly the association with good faith, bad faith, intent, all those subjective elements kind of make it really difficult to claim abuse, not only because it's difficult to prove that somebody had exercised their right in bad faith or with a specific intent. That's not news, and that's not specific to this. So does the UK need a distinct doctrine of abuse of rights? Do you think I'm in favor or against? I'm kind of testing the water here. I'm curious if you think we should go for something. Actually, I don't think so. Probably not would be my end. Woo! It's okay. I live here now. I don't go back to Europe. Nobody's going to be mad at me. I'd say probably not for multiple reasons, but more specifically that because despite some differences in concepts that already exist, there is a functional parallelism between the various concepts of abuse that we've seen in the EU and UK concepts. Plus, UK is slightly less focused on subjective criterion, which I think is an advantage. And it has been historically a reason why the UK had refused to recognize abuse of rights, because abuse of rights was based on the intent and the subjective elements. And so that there is this idea that if there is similarities in concept between abuse of rights and UK developments, it should not fall in the completely intent-based understanding of abuse. And so there are different mechanisms that already exist, abuse of process, oppressive, unjustified kind of exercise of rights in terms of litigation. Again, my focus was on patent litigation. Principle of nuisance, equity, principles that are embedded in the civil procedure rules already kind of incorporate some functions of abuse. Specific criteria we find, or I found through the case law, that the intention to harm, the right function and proportionality played quite a bit of a role within the UK case law. And the criteria would lose a connection to abuse. There's also estoppel that could work. So that's my conclusion. I don't know, maybe Lionel, you hope that I would say, yes, let's go for more abuse of rights doctrine. But I have my reservations about it. I've thought about it a lot. So if you're interested, there's 410 pages on abuse of rights in European patent law, plus a list of other things which look into abuse and all of this in slightly more details. All of this with the UPC in mind, the patent assertion entities in mind, sometimes in French, sometimes in English, because need to reach a maximum audience. But yes, abuse of right has been on my desk for quite some time. And that's it.
So thank you, Amandine. It's worth reflecting that, as Amandine pointed out, abuse of rights is established, it has been established for quite some time as a general principle of EU law. And it has been specifically applied quite a lot in the context of VAT. And of course, in that context, has been well recognized in our domestic case law here in England and Wales. You can find plenty of cases in the Court of Appeal dealing with abuse of rights in VAT law. And one might ask the question, well, given prior to 2020, this was well established in UK VAT law, why was it never raised in intellectual property rights? I mean, let's take the example of copyright trolls. So if I wind back to the GoldenEye case, how do we deal with GoldenEye? Well, there's never any argument raised about abuse of rights in that case. And instead, exactly as Amandine has described, the way it was dealt with was through equity and through procedural mechanisms. Maybe that's characteristic of the English preference, I don't know. So that's the European position. Let's see if we can get some help from across the pond. And we have Leah Greenwald from the University of Nevada to see if she can give us any lessons from the US.